Can I get the icon in cornflower? Blue flower.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 23 of Can I Get That Software in Blue? I'm one of your hosts, Chad Tindall. Along with me is my co-host, still the open source radical, but no longer on sabbatical. By day, he works at Empathic, but at night, he hits the trails in his UTV to cause havoc. He runs sales and recently returned from a team meeting in Hawaii where he got to see some whales. Welcome, Steve. I hate elevator music. Mazak.
Thanks, Chad. It's good to see you. So I've been off sabbatical for a month now, so I think we need to like come up with another joke, but I'll give you some ideas.
I'll work on something.
Yeah,
I'm running out of rhymes here. I need someone to punch me up. Well, you have been, so you've been at Empathic for about a month now. How's that going? How's it feel to run sales instead of just being on the SA side?
Well, I mean, right now it's just like crazy startup life, right? So every day it's five different priorities and then the next day they change, which is what I love. So it's been a lot of fun. And, you know, Empathic right now is trying to find product market fit. So there's a few places where we absolutely have it. And then for the broader market, we're just running a bunch of experiments. And so it's just really cool. And, you know, working for Gren, she's a clinical psychologist. It's just a different kind of company, right? You can feel it from the moment you start. And then, you know, we did the offsite last week and it just felt different, like a good kind of different. So yeah, things are pretty exciting there. Like we're getting some traction. It's fun.
That's awesome. How is all of this stuff with ChatGPT and, you know, Google announcing their competitor to it? How is that factoring into what you guys are talking about and doing there?
Well, it's interesting. So like all that stuff is kind of happening very quickly, right? Like it's kind of like when the iPhone launched, I haven't worked the same since.
Right.
I think with ChatGPT and GPT-3 coming out like it did, it's spreading like wildfire and it's changing how people think about their work slowly but surely. And I think what we're doing is, you know, we're built on GPT under the covers, but what we've seen and, you know, Empathic has known before, long before I joined, was that these large language models are great, but they're also generic. And so what you get is this very vanilla kind of text that's like the culmination of the average of everybody, right? It's like,
so. Well, and they're also very constrained in terms of like, there's a lot of things they won't answer, for example, right?
Right.
They're locked down.
Yeah, and so like it might feel human, but it's not. It's a robot that's trying to sound human, and Empathic can really take it to the next level by putting the human back in AI potentially. And, you know, empathy being our definition of empathy is like shared understanding. That's the quickest way to say it. It's not about like being all touchy-feely. I mean, that's a part of it because you're gonna need to sense things, but it's much more about getting to shared understanding. So with the things that we detect, these are detections that the labelers have been labeling for years on, you know, different data sets that are clinical data sets. So we have, I think, a pretty wide moat around us, because if you want to do the same thing we do, either there needs to be a yet another kind of amazing advance in AI technology, or you just have to do the work and put people on it and label it. And that's what GPT's been doing, right? Like that news article came out about how they were sourcing their labelers. Not the greatest image for them. We're not doing that, obviously. We're using professionals to do the labeling, but it's one of those things where it's been building and building and building behind the scenes for years, and all of a sudden the coming out party happens, and now everybody's like, well, look what we can do, look what we can do. And it's not like they just showed up, right? Empathic's been doing this for years. So I think that's going to be the most interesting thing, is who can add the domain knowledge on top of GPT or these large language models and make them actually work for specific use cases, ours being empathy.
It's funny you mentioned the iPhone thing, because I literally just last night said to my wife, like, because I've been working with ChatGPT for the last couple months, programming with it. And every time I want to do something in code, I ask it first to see what it can do. And it is just amazing. It's like magic. That and GitHub's Copilot, I've kind of been using both a lot lately, and they both feel like magic. And I actually said to her, the last time I felt like this was the first time I used an iPhone, like back in 2008.
Yeah,
so, it does feel like that. It's like, and of course that changed the world, right?
Yeah.
Everything is different now, and this feels like that. Yeah. It's the first time I felt like that since 2008, probably.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Like, we've all been in tech for a while. I'm sure we've had these moments where it's like, this is so cool that I need to tell people that are not in tech. And I haven't done that in a while. But last night I was with a friend, and I was asking her if she had heard of ChatGPT, and she hadn't. And I told her what it was, and then I said, let's ask it a question. I was kind of demoing it for her. And I said, what's something that you're struggling with right now? And she's like, I'm trying to promote my business, because she's a massage therapist, or she does facials, sorry. And she's trying to figure out how to do AdWords and stuff like that. I said, watch this, ChatGPT, give me the top 20 AdWords in comma separated format or whatever for, you know, a search engine. And it just started printing them out. And she was like, you know, mouth hit the floor moment. I said, watch this. If you wanted to write a blog post on why facials are great for you, I said, you know, write me a blog post on why facials are great. And she's just like stunned. So, you know, I think she asked me three times, what was the name of that again?
It's funny. It tells you what kind of bubble we're living in, that there's still people who haven't heard of it. And it's like all anybody in our world is talking about.
That's right. But you go outside of our bubble and
they don't know about
it. What is this thing? Yeah.
That's hilarious. Our guest today was formerly the director of product management for Kibana. Now he's the head of product at Zeta, which recently launched out of beta. He grew up on the mean streets where he learned to rap and make sick beats. Hailing from West Newberry, his favorite dessert is a whoopie pie made of blueberry. Alex Francoeur, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I didn't know I'd get one of those. Oh, man, Chad.
Everybody gets one, Alex. Everybody gets one.
All right. I love it.
It's really hard because there's no words that rhyme with product or management that don't have the words product or management in them. Yeah. It's like co-product, mismanagement. I'm like, that's not a rhyme. That's just a longer word of the same thing.
PM. You could have gone far with PM, I bet.
That's true. You probably could have gone far with that one.
I will say my favorite ones to date is still the Sultana of Grafana. I thought that was
really good.
That was a good one. Yeah.
I had that at a moment of inspiration, is sitting on the couch and I was like, I got to email myself that or I'm going to forget it.
I appreciate you taking kind of like my local geography and mapping to the desserts that are popular here. Like that took a little bit of research, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I know blueberry whoopie pies are big up in the Massachusetts and Maine. So,
yeah. Also,
that's like Hot Ones level of research, Chad. I'm impressed.
Yeah, I don't even have a research staff. I had to do that research myself.
He's just like to ChatGPT, what desserts are popular in Massachusetts?
But the problem is, I've been to Maine and up in that area, so I've had the blueberry whoopie pies. Oh, they're so good.
Too funny, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited. It's been a while.
This is our first episode with someone from product management. And obviously in the field, we interact with product management all the time. It's a critical relationship in order for the company to be successful. And so we're going to be exploring some of that today. We previously had the founder and CEO of Zeta on last year. Monica Sarbu was on episode 14. But for anybody listening who may not have heard that episode, can you just give us a quick overview of what you're building at Zeta so people know?
Yeah. And let me just start by saying that episode was a tipping point, I think, for me to actually reach out to Monica to join Zeta. And that was a great, episode. Cool. And I learned a lot about the company a bit more. I'd been following for a while. And so I was like, you know what, I'm just going to reach out and see if she's interested in PM joining.
Right on.
That's awesome.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. So Zeta is, we are building a serverless data platform. And so what that means is we are really trying to provide the absolute best experience for all of your data needs under a single API. We started initially with kind of like having Postgres and Elasticsearch on the back end to provide kind of a search and analytics use case on top of a relational database. But the sky's the limit with this, I think, approach. And we really want to tackle a number of different use cases using best practices and standards out there. And so we're just kind of at the tip of the surface right now, trying to find product market fit. I think we have it very much so with kind of front end developers, folks in the Jamstack ecosystem, but we'd like to branch out in the next year or so into some other technologies and ecosystems. And I don't know, it's an exciting use case for me because at least at Elastic, I know we saw that architecture a lot and it was a common use case. And so being able to support that with as minimal effort to the developer as possible is, I don't know, pretty exciting to me. And I'm looking forward to branching out into kind of new areas.
So the idea is that your service provides an API that people can put their data into and it works over time as an operational data store, an analytics data store. It has the search indexes on it. Kind of all of that just happens magically behind the scenes. Is that right?
That is the idea in a consumption-based model. So you pay what you use for. Really trying to make it easy to work with data.
It's a great idea because, I mean, obviously I'm a data solution architect at AWS and, you know, we just spend a lot of time helping people move things around from their DynamoDB into their Redshift, into their, you know, OpenSearch or Elasticsearch or whatever they're using. And there's just so much glue involved in doing that if you can build a service that just does it all magically, that's awesome.
That's the idea. We're the glue in between those two types of technologies right now, and maybe some other ones in the future. Really trying to just allow you to throw as much data into for your application as possible and scale with us. And so it's definitely, I know it's been interesting in the early days to see what's getting built on us. Seeing more Web3 than I would have expected. Yeah. Because I don't know, front end technologies and front end developers seem to be gravitating towards some of the new stuff. I imagine we'll be seeing some ChatGPT kind of implementations in the not too distant future.
I'm sure.
But yeah, it's pretty fun. And in a similar boat as you, Steve, where we're really trying to figure out our product market fit right now and get that right and branch out into new areas. And it's a million different priorities today and a million different ones tomorrow. Like, I don't know, this is what I signed up for. It's what I asked for in a startup mode. And it's been a blast so far. And Monica and the team are absolutely amazing here.
That's awesome. It's fun being in that world where, like, you're not sure what's going to happen today. I love that. I thrive in that environment. If I had to work at a big company, you know, with thousands and thousands of employees, like, I just don't know that I would love it as much. So, but one thing I do want to say about Zeta is when I was researching it for the conversation with Monica and then, you know, up and coming Alex, I wanted to see what had changed. There's so many things that you don't have to worry about anymore, but there's also new concepts that I hadn't really thought of much, like branching in the database, like, and then, you know, zero downtime migration. So not to be a commercial for this product, but it's pretty freaking cool. So if you're looking for something and you don't want to have to be a DBA, I highly recommend trying it out. And some of the people that are talking about it online are loving it already. So you're building some pretty amazing champions, it seems like, early on.
Yeah, the concept of database branching I saw on your blog this morning, I thought that was such a great idea.
Yeah.
Very cool. It's like you decided to fix all the problems with databases all at once.
Yeah.
Yeah, it aligns very much with kind of the way people are building web apps these days, I think. Like the Vercel and Netlify workflows, the preview and deploy, having just a data branch associated with that. I mean, it removes the need for a staging environment. You kind of have your own personal development environment as soon as you create a preview. And so that's kind of the direction that we're focusing on in the not too distant future, to make sure that we are really providing the best experience there for working with these deploy preview workflows. And so it is very front end focused today, but we're really going to continue to improve the DX for other languages as well.
That makes sense. So there's a lot of different paths to becoming a product manager. Some people come from the engineering side, some people come from sales or SA side, some come from marketing. So tell us a little bit about why did you want to be a PM and what was your background? How did you get into it?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. I've interviewed a lot of product managers as well in the past, and everyone has a new story, like something unique that I haven't heard before, how they found their way into PM. I don't think there is like a single way to get here. You see engineering, you see kind of like a post-sales SE kind of role coming into this as well. But I had a different approach. So I graduated from school and immediately took the first job that I was offered, and that was with tech support. And so I kind of worked my way up the chain there. At some point, I basically knew the product through and through and ended up becoming a technical account manager and having more interaction kind of with the business side and the customers. And that was something that I really enjoyed. And then at some point, a product role opened up in the company. I had domain expertise in this area, and I worked with a number of the larger customers already anyway. And so it felt like a really good fit. I didn't really know much about PM at that time when I made that transition, and definitely learned a lot along the way. My first product gig was at a company called Dynatrace, building out their next generation synthetic monitoring solution.
So Alex, when you think about the difference between the different roles you've had as you've come up to be the head of product at Zeta, like you started out as, I think, a PM, then director of PM, now head of product. Like, how do you think about that, the transitions and roles? Like, what are some of the main skills that you had to learn as you became a leader over time?
I would say that as an IC or an individual contributor, one of the best things you can do is execute. And that is really what you're measured on. That's really kind of where your success lies. That requires a couple of different things, right? I mean, so you're on a smaller team, you don't have as much influence. And I kind of view building, I don't know what to call it, but like building up your influence, kind of trust amongst the team is probably the most critical thing you can do. And that's the way that you grow within an organization. And so I really think being able to influence others relies heavily on kind of relationship building and trust. And so I find different and unique ways to do that throughout my career. And I'm in the early IC days, it's very much gaining the trust of individuals on the team. And each person, I think, I handle like a bit differently. Like I meet them where they're at. One example that I can think of is working with Rashid Khan, kind of the creator of Kibana. He was a tough nut to crack. I mean, like he is one of my favorite people. But when I first met him, he's like right off the bat, like his kind of walls up, and he's like, I don't trust you. Like you have to prove it to me. One of the first things I did with him is get super technical, build a prototype out on something that he was building. And then it was much easier to work together and collaborate. And so little things like that, I think, make a huge difference in how you work with others. Building up those trusts at that level, at that stage as an IC, is probably the most important thing in order to execute more effectively.
Yeah, that makes sense. So when you started managing product managers, like, did that change your kind of perspective on the role a little bit and give you kind of expand your horizons, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely part of it. So Gaurav's been on this show as well. Shout out to Gaurav. I love Gaurav. He said something very early on to me at Elastic, because it's an interesting thought, I think. As someone growing in a product management role, I feel like it's relatively difficult to stay an individual contributor. And I know on the engineering side, I think that ICs and kind of like, I don't even know what you call them, like some exceptional engineer that essentially can grow throughout an org and hit different levels by building amazing and innovative things. But it's hard to do that as a product manager without taking on more people. And so I think the management aspect definitely is something that if you're going to grow as a PM, is something that you have to come to expect.
Yeah, the article you're talking about was the Bloomberg article about Meta / Facebook asking managers to stop managing and go back to being individual contributors. Basically, they're trying to flatten their organizations so they have more doers and fewer managers, which it seems to be going on. I mean, Elon Musk like fired a bunch of people who hadn't checked in codes. Like, have you checked in code in the last year? No. Well, then we don't need you anymore. Right. And that was one of the major decision-making criteria he used at Twitter when deciding who to let go. And I don't know. I just thought that article was interesting. I just read that yesterday.
Well, I can say you don't want me committing code to any production applications. but I have a little bit of background, I think, with kind of mentoring, coaching, and kind of managing people. But starting back from like high school, I was captain of my soccer team. Like, I don't know, you have a different mentality, I think, with when you have that sense of leadership just in a certain role. With managing product managers, I definitely had some team lead expertise or experience when I was in customer support, but this was probably the first time I was actually managing product managers at Elastic. And the way that they did it there was that you still want to have like maybe 50% of your time being an individual contributor and the rest delegating to your team. And so I wasn't committing code, but being an IC was definitely part of the expectations, I think, for managing people at Elastic. I don't know. I really enjoy the coaching mentality, and I really enjoy growing people to their career goals. And it's been pretty fun so far. At Zeta, I don't have any PMs underneath me, but I've inherited the DevRel team. That's been an interesting experience as well, learning a new field in a bit more detail, but also managing and trying to grow those individuals within the team.
Alex, I think this is a good kind of segue into this next topic I wanted to ask you about, which is, how do you know if you're building the right thing? Like, how do you test things? How do you sense whether or not this feature is more important than that feature, especially at this stage of the company?
We launched in November officially. They had been in private beta, I think, for little less than a year. And so we're still very early days, right? Being able to measure the success was one of the first things that I wanted to do coming into the team. So making sure that we had some sort of product analytics hooked up. There's definitely room for improvement on the tools that we're using and kind of what we're measuring, but being able to see like if things that we're putting out there are actually working. And that is one of the benefits of SaaS for me. And so I would say we're in discovery mode still, but we're taking kind of educated bets, I'd say. We know users are asking for certain capabilities. We know there's an opportunity for certain areas, like things like database branching with zero downtime migrations is a relatively new concept that we're getting good traction and feedback on from our users.
Okay. Do you have like a kind of set of test users that you work with on a regular basis where you deploy things to them first, or is it just release it and see how it goes?
We haven't gotten to the point that we're like building prototypes for specific users to use, but I do have a list. I have a list that have been okay. Of people who have raised their hand for it. I would say right now because we're still pretty early, we're just kind of pushing things to production and seeing how they sit and then iterating if it doesn't quite work out. But that's been working so far, and we've seen some good traction in certain areas.
Yeah, that makes sense. How is it different than working with an open source company? Like, you've done both. So what are some of the main differences you've noticed?
So I went from proprietary to open source, back to proprietary. I will say, like, I love both types of product building. On the open source side, things, at least in my experience, things can move a little slower when it comes to experimentation, for example. And that could have just been the way that Elastic had built out their cloud solution and how they were hosting kind of their open source project. But even just getting the metrics in, I remember, was a relatively difficult thing to do.
That's because you don't know how people are using the product?
Yeah, there's just less visibility. It's particularly putting things like product analytics into an open source project. I mean, that's a hard sell. And so you really only get a certain level of insights once you're kind of hosting those products. I don't know, that is one aspect. The other is more of a competitive nature. I think you're always competing against yourself as sales folks in at Elastic. You ran into that a bit. On the product building side, I would say more so it was along the lines of moved a bit slower in open source, but the community was amazing. So you got a lot of good qualitative feedback. Where on the SaaS side, it's a bit more difficult to build a community. It takes a different approach, but you have quantitative metrics at your fingertips at all times.
Yeah. I feel like SaaS is really spoiling us right now, because I agree with you on open source. It might sound counterintuitive, but when you don't know who's using your software and it's freely available to download, one of the ways you do that is, you know, put some analytics in the software to send back, or some data, but people don't want to do that all the time. So SaaS has spoiled me for sure.
It's nice being back, I gotta admit, but and just the speed of release. There are many things that go into that. I wouldn't say it's just open source, but it's a nice refreshing take, but it is harder to build a community around a proprietary product.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this quite a bit just over my career, because I've worked for so many open source companies. And when the cloud started to become the dominant way to deploy new software, new projects, I've been asking myself, like, does open source matter in a cloud first world? Like, if everyone can just consume their software via SaaS, who cares about open source? I'm curious to get your thoughts on that. Like, I have my own opinions, but what do you think? Yeah, do you think open source matters as much nowadays?
That's super interesting that you say that, because I had been thinking about writing a blog post along these lines, because Zeta is trying to take some open source values and bring them to a proprietary solution, right? And so the three things that I see that really stand out for open source technologies are, one, they're free. You can't beat that, right? Like, you can pull it down, you can build something on it, and it's yours. Two is the transparency factor, right? You can see absolutely everything that's happening within an open source project, and you know exactly what it is. And the third is avoiding vendor lock-in, and they all kind of play well together. And if you can provide a solution that hits all those three things, like, honestly, it begs the question if how much open source really does help in the sales cycle, and how much it matters.
I just asked ChatGPT, does open source matter in an age of SaaS? That was my question.
Well, yeah, what did it say?
Open source still matters in an age of SaaS for several reasons. Flexibility: open source allows for more customization and control. Cost: open source software is often free, while SaaS can be expensive. Security: open source can be audited and improved by a community of developers, increasing security. Innovation: open source drives innovation by allowing developers to build on existing code. Competition: open source helps maintain competition in the software market by preventing a single company from having a monopoly on technology. However, SaaS has its own advantages, such as ease of use, convenience, and the ability to access software from anywhere with an internet connection. They both have a role to play in the industry, and the choice between them often depends on specific needs and requirements. I mean,
well, there's my blog post.
That's an amazing answer.
It's all right. It's not amazing. Honestly, like, there's some stuff in there. Chad, what was the third thing it said, or the
security?
Second or third team?
Well, yeah. Flexibility, cost, security.
Security. So
yeah,
security. What was the last big breach we had in the tech community? If I recall correctly, it was Log4j, which is open source.
Well, I don't think so, that means anyway.
For the audits.
Yeah, it's more about the you know, if that hadn't been open source, maybe we never would have known about it.
Well, that's the thing. You could argue that, like, there's plenty of proprietary software that's not secure, but we don't know.
Right.
So, yeah.
But anyway, the customization aspect's interesting, because that is one thing that you just can't get unless you build it into the product itself.
Well, I don't know why people aren't building pluggability into SaaS products more, to be honest. Like,
yeah, it's an interesting idea.
Allow people to customize it. Like, I mean, I know it was hard. Like, certain plugins were allowed on Elastic Cloud, but not others. But a lot of SaaS offerings just have no plugin option at all.
It's such a double-edged sword, though. Like, you look at how companies use things like Salesforce.com, which I consider highly customizable. Holy cow, the migration from the old UI to Lightning, which is their newer one, was a nightmare because of the customizations. A lot of it was about the customization. So, and I've seen this in my career over and over again, like ERP systems that used to be customized to the point where you could no longer upgrade them. I even had a company that I worked with when I was at SpringSource that had forked Tomcat and gotten to a place with Tomcat where there was a CVE that they could no longer like backport into their fork. And they had no choice but to change their entire platform. And it was like over 3,000 servers that were running their modified version of Tomcat. And that was a very painful thing for them. So
yeah, WordPress plugins can be a nightmare to upgrade. Yeah.
So I don't know what the right answer is here. I do agree that we need to have more composability and expandability, but you got to kind of proceed with caution, I think.
And there is like we talked about open source and SaaS, but there is that open core model that Elastic kind of moved into. And I have to say, from my perspective, there was very little impact on how people used us when with that transition. There was a lot of noise, but moving away from like a Apache 2 to ELv2 or Elastic License V2, it didn't impact the sales cycle as much and adoption as much, as long as we were providing value.
I think most people don't really care about the license, honestly. They just want to know if they're going to breach it. And if they think they're not going to breach it, then they'll move on. All right, Alex, let's talk about the future of software product. Like, how do you go about planning what you're going to build? And do you think about it in terms of quarters or 6 months or years? How do you think about that?
I'd say right now at Zeta, we're really trying to figure out the next year. And maybe we don't have everything right, but it's a good trajectory for which we want to go. And if we need to pivot for any reason, then we could. But I would say at the moment, from a product perspective, we're planning out kind of what our big bets are for the next year. This is actually happening right now. From then on, it's kind of the product planning cadence, I think, varies a bit by team, just given how long it takes to build certain things. And so there's less of like a common approach to like the execution aspect, but we are aligning very much on what big bets we want to make and how are we going to remove blockers for adoption.
Are you shipping new releases every quarter? Or are you trying to do like more 2-week sprints and be much faster given that you're so new?
Fast. We want to move fast. And so it's going into production. Maybe we make a tweet and a blog about it. We promote a little bit. And then when one of the larger items lands, we'll do a bigger marketing campaign or launch campaign. Roughly, maybe we try and do those quarterly. But if we have something new that is going to bring value to our users, I see no reason in holding for a marketing campaign, essentially.
But you're not trying to maintain a sort of like 2-week sprint cycle or something consistent?
Not right now. And that is something that maybe will change over time. At Elastic and even at Dynatrace before, they were a bit more stringent on kind of how we did sprints, but we didn't call them sprints. No one likes that term anymore.
What do they call it?
Yeah.
We had one of the teams. So I worked with a lot of teams at Elastic, and just the whole like agile mentality in terminology is, I don't know, like saying you want to bring Jira into a company. And there's just, I don't know, there's certain feelings that come with those things. Sprint became laps for one of the teams, which I think actually aligns with how GitHub boards work, which is interesting.
Right on. So Chad and I have a theory we want to talk to you about, which is, wouldn't it be better if engineers just reported to product management? Go.
Yeah. Go. Well, just to give it a little background to tee that up, I mean, we had read this article and we kind of shared it before this recording session, which was about understanding how to lead through influence and the fact that product managers don't have engineering working for them. Typically at most companies, engineering rolls up separately. Product management is sort of dotted line or whatever, but your work involves influencing them to kind of build this product that you think that customers will use. But they don't work for you. You can't force them to do it. You can't fire them if they don't implement your vision. So why shouldn't, I mean, I guess if product management is supposed to be viewed as like the CEO of the product, which is said all the time, but CEOs can fire people like who work underneath them and product managers can't. And yeah, so why shouldn't they roll up to product management?
It's interesting because at Elastic in particular, like we distinctly moved away from that and had product report up to engineering. And so at the end of the day, if that were the case, I don't necessarily think the working like day to day might change as much. I mean, there's still a lot of influencing that's required in order to get things done. I personally, I don't know, don't like to rule with a heavy hand, I guess, if you will. And so I guess I can see the incentive for having that power, but I don't think you'll be successful using it. And by that, I mean, like, I don't think you can threaten the livelihood of somebody to get something done versus coming to an agreement, collaborating, and delivering things that our users want.
Yeah, I don't think everybody needs to be all Elon Musk about it.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't saying that, to be clear, but certainly there is a difference when you're reporting to somebody versus not reporting to them, even if it's just how you approach the job, right?
Yeah, that's fair. I don't see how the day-to-day would change much, but I think there could be a bit more structure in how things are done. And so I don't know. Like if I look at how we're approaching product at Zeta right now, I'm coming to the table with a roadmap. I'm working with Monica on what business goals we want to achieve. And then the team will collaborate on best on how to execute on them. And not just that, but also provide input. The reporting structure, in my opinion, probably wouldn't change the way that we work for the most part. But yeah, I'm curious to hear your thoughts, Steve. It sounds like you have some strong opinions here.
Well, I don't know that they're strong. They're more like loose opinions, loosely held, because I've never been a PM and I haven't been an engineer for a while. But I was just thinking, like, it's great what you were talking about earlier about influence. I think that is absolutely the right way to build product and, you know, trying to get the best out of people by convincing them that this is what they should build and, you know, it's the best thing for the company. But I think when there's competing priorities and then when you get into maintenance mode and there's not a lot of fun stuff to work on, it's just like bug fixes and maintaining the software. That's where I've seen it kind of get a little more contentious. So I'm just curious to hear from you, Alex, like when you think about your previous experiences at more established companies, because Zeta probably doesn't have this problem yet too much. It's like, how do you get people to work on the boring stuff and the fun stuff? Like, how do you balance that?
In my past, I would come to an agreement, like you could do like a percentage type of agreement, but it ends up coming down to how you're planning the work for the next couple of weeks or a couple of months. Yes, I can see it being useful in past experiences if maybe engineer did report to products, but at the end of the day, that might have led to more features and a buggier system, if that makes sense. And so I still think it's a discussion, it's a collaboration, and having that level of kind of reporting I don't necessarily think would be the best thing. It could work. And I know in one of the articles there was some discussion around, should engineering be held to like a number, like a revenue number, in a similar fashion. And I don't know, That could also lead to some very interesting outcomes for how products are built, right? If they're focused on bringing in revenue.
I mean, it might be more of an issue at bigger companies. Obviously, you're not facing this at a startup. Yeah, yeah. Everybody's working on cool new features that are going out, right? But we were talking about this in the context of two big companies, Facebook and Google. The Facebook problem, well, when John Carmack left Facebook recently, he wrote a big open letter. And, you know, I'll just quote a little paragraph here. He said, "We have a ridiculous amount of people and resources, but we constantly self-sabotage and squander effort. There's no way to sugarcoat this. I think our organization is operating at half the effectiveness that would make me happy." Some may scoff and contend we're doing just fine, but others will laugh and say, "Half, ha, I'm actually only at a quarter efficiency." And so one of the reasons that he left was he felt that could there be a more influential person in the graphics world and the computer vision world and all that stuff that he's done? And yet he feels like he can't influence this massive machine at Facebook enough to move the needle. So he quit. And Google has this kind of similar problem, which is that in order for people to get promoted, they have to show impact of working on new releases, new features, and things like that. And so nobody wants to work on the boring maintenance of an existing product, which is why Google is constantly just putting them out to pasture and killing products all the time, because their whole ethos is we only really value people doing new releases.
I have a side comment around Google.
We can edit this out.
But yeah, go ahead and say it. Yeah,
okay. I mean, I just like, I, the killing products is like kills me. I came into technology, like the Android was the first phone I got that was a smartphone because it had GPS. Amazing feature, right? And I'm still with them, very close to switching to iPhone, I think, but like,
I just switched last year. Yeah.
Four different messaging apps. Like, get it together. Like, yeah. Figure it out. I don't know.
It's more than four. I mean, there's like a dozen or 15 or yeah. something. That's why I left. I left Google because of the messaging apps, or I left Android because of the messaging apps.
But let's, if we bring that back to like the product direction, okay. All right. So, heavy hands, this messaging app didn't work. Let's kill the rest, right? Or let's kill it and build a new one. I don't know. That's, you remove maintenance and you're focused on a new go-to-market, the end user experience suffers, right? Yeah.
The question is, would that have happened if engineering worked for the product managers who could tell them, you know, you need to maintain this thing instead of just worrying about building a new one?
Maybe. I think it's going to come down to the individuals. Like, I don't know. If you have a good working relationship with your VP of engineering, for instance, and you're on the same page, you'll rarely run into this issue. I could go back and forth on it, but I think at Elastic, they even transitioned to a CPO having engineering underneath them also. So, I mean, things change over time. Maybe as you grow, that's just a better approach where somebody is strategically thinking about exactly what investments we need to keep versus killing off products and building new ones. Yeah.
Alex, let's talk a little bit about incentives. Like, we've been kind of hinting at it and a little bit. What are the best incentives for product managers? Because, you know, in sales, it's very easy. It's money. I think that's the easiest incentive to throw out and probably the most corrupting, honestly. Yeah. But I've often thought that maybe PMs should have a P&L, or they should be on some sort of commission for their product. These are not, you know, concrete thoughts, but I'm just like, what about this and what about that? What's your take on incentives and kind of how they influence your decision processes?
Well, I would say, being tied to revenue, I can totally understand how a product manager could and would be incentivized by that. But then at the same time, you might be deathly focused on increasing that number, whether it's number of users, which is something that I'm focused on right now, whether it's revenue in particular. Like, you change the way that you build a product will be influenced specifically by that incentive, right? I haven't worked at an organization where I've had an incentive that is tied to directly to the business, but I know a number of PMs who have. It does keep you focused.
Well, and let me just extend that again. Like, do you think that engineering bonuses, or however you want to think about it, should be based on product revenue to some extent?
To some extent, like a trickle-down effect.
Like, why isn't the whole company just motivated towards selling this product? Is there something that matters more than that? Like,
there's not. I would agree with you. There's nothing more important for a business than selling the product. And that's not just engineering, though. I mean, that hits everybody, right? So you could equally ask the same question for marketing folks.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I would. Why aren't we all incentivized to sell the product in the whole company?
And I feel like there's some maybe personal experiences here that you've both had around this.
No, I mean, yes, you're right. Yes, that's true. But I mean, even just thinking abstractly, like,
yeah,
why isn't the incentive for everybody to just be based on how well the product sells?
It couldn't just be based on it.
Not just based on it, but most people, if you're not in sales, your incentives are not tied to revenue at all in any way. Right, except maybe stock price, or, you know, something a little more abstract, but nothing like in the short term.
Sometimes the stock price isn't abstract. I'd say if you're joining, mean, if you're joining a successful company, like, that is probably one of the reasons why you join, and you are incentivized for that stock number to continue to raise, right?
Well, yeah. I think that a lot of people feel disconnected. Like, they might do something and the stock price kind of moves up and down, you know, with the market, irrespective of like the work that you do. But it's a little easier to say, yeah, these things I do bring revenue to the company somehow, and I want to do that more and better.
At least at the companies that I've worked at, everyone's been relatively aligned on making sure that the company itself is successful without the incentives. And so maybe at some point you just get to a large enough of an organization where you need to make that pivot, and leaders need to start holding people accountable for those types of, for moving the needle, I guess, on things like revenue.
Yeah, and it might not just be revenue. It might just be profits in general, because, right, you might work on a feature that doesn't bring new revenue, but it might be way more efficient and lower the cost of the company or whatever, right? So actually, you know, could be either one, but I don't know. I just feel like if I were building a company, I would want everybody focused on that because.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, right? Like people who start companies come from different backgrounds. If you come from sales, yeah. That's probably going to be one of them. If you are more of a product oriented person, really you just care about adoption and users and product led growth, right? Like the actual sales cycle comes further down the line. At the end of the day, you need to make money. I just think the way that people approach it probably have a lot to do with their experience and background. So I could see, Chad, if you started a company, it would very much be aligned towards let's sell this thing and make sure that it's that we're making profit as soon as possible. Yeah, I don't know. Steve, what are your loosely held thoughts on this?
I think you're right. Like Chad and I come from sales. We've been doing that for a long time. And I think that influences how we think. But I also like to question the establishment probably more than is healthy for me. And so I'm questioning these incentives a lot lately, like, because I'm, you know, now leading the go-to-market efforts at Empathic, and I'm trying to figure out how to build a new type of sales organization that's incentivized a different way, which is a tall order, right? Like, how do I make sure that these incentives don't corrupt the activities or the actions that people would take to go and earn those, right? And I think this is probably going to be controversial, and I don't really care. I think the way that sales reps are incentives actually leads to more bad behavior than good, potentially, or maybe it's a mix just based on what I've seen. And so I don't know what would happen if you started saying, oh, hey, all of our engineers are now going to be incentivized to, you know, or they're going to have a variable compensation that's part of, you know, the sales number and all that stuff. And I think that gets tricky. It also gets hard to plan for in an organization. Like if you have a really big quarter, did you do the math right? Or are you going to have to basically empty the bank account to pay everybody because you just blew out your number? That's going to be a challenge.
That feels like a solvable problem. I mean, that's just a spreadsheet modeling issue. They know how to solve that problem.
Yeah, it does. But like, will it matter, right? Like, will it matter at the end of the day if an engineer gets, you know, a $5,000 paycheck or a $5,100 paycheck? It's kind of like real estate agents, you know? If the price goes down 10 grand on the house, they're not losing that much in commission. And so their incentive is to sell the house, and they probably have a, you know, a bar where they're saying, this is the least commission I'll make, so therefore I can lower the price. Whereas I'm the customer and I, you know, lose all that additional potential value in selling the house. So I think there's psychology like that that I don't fully understand. But I do think it's interesting to just challenge some of these old held assumptions. Like, why is it the way it is? You know, why are reps compensated the way they are? Why are engineers incentivized the way they are? And just figure out new ways to do it. I always wanted engineers to think about it in a very simple way, which is like, if this product doesn't do well, I don't get a paycheck, which means I can't put food on the table and I got to go find a new job. I think that is an incentive, but that's just me.
Yeah. Right? Like survival incentive.
Yeah. And you know, coming from sales, you might think that I really chase that number. Like I don't actually chase the number. I see it. I know it's there. I know that's the target. I do not lose sleep over not getting there, like day over day. So that pressure that I see a lot of reps under and some SEs, I don't feel the same pressure because my mentality is if we run a great organization and do everything we can to the best of our ability, we will get to that number. We just will. And that's proven to be true for me and more over my entire career.
I do like challenging the status quo. And I do think there probably are other ways to incentivize that would drive different behavior. I don't have any that are top of mind.
I would love to chat about it eventually. Like I'm, you know, putting a lot of ideas on paper. I've been doing that for a while now. And there's some areas in my mind where I'm like, am I missing something obvious here? Or is it really just that simple? It's just like, no one's ever challenged this really before. They failed in challenging it. And you just need to, you know, turn the lever and you get a different behavior. So we'll see. Like, that's the kind of stuff I'm going to be experimenting with. And I do think, you know, sales reps have a pretty bad reputation. Let's be honest. Like you talk to most people, they don't like the sales experience at all. Why is that? Well, in my experience, it's because pressure's coming down on that rep to close. And so they do unnatural things to try and influence someone to buy. And there's terms like buyer's remorse. Why does that term exist? Why do we have a term called buyer's remorse? It means that they're being convinced to do something that they don't feel like they should be doing, but somehow, you know, the great rep was able to convince them and then they have buyer's remorse and they'll probably never go back to that person or, you know, whatever the kind of knock-on effects are of having buyer's remorse. You just kind of feel cheated a little bit. Like, I don't know how else to describe it right now, but
yeah, but I think that's the great reps don't do that. right? They don't push a sale that doesn't make sense. So you're right that if you're pushing a sale that doesn't make sense for the customer, they're going to have a bad experience and feel bad about it afterwards.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, just at Empathic, just in the short time I've been there, I've talked to our CEO about this because we want to embody and model the behavior that our company stands for. So how do you build a sales process based on empathy? It's an interesting challenge for sure. That's part of the reason I'm here. But like, Chad, I agree with you. You don't want to push where there's not an obvious sale, but then that means, you know, you got to kind of stop selling when normally you know that if you don't say these five different things, Gong's going to call you out to your boss and they're going to be like, well, why didn't you say this? And why didn't you say that? It's like, because it was obvious they weren't going to buy. Like, are you not seeing what I'm seeing and hearing what I'm hearing? But there's this Pavlovian response we have to know, which is, oh, I can't accept the first no. I got to get to seven of them. And it's not a comfortable experience for anybody. So that's one of the behaviors I'm trying to challenge in myself right now is like, oh, I've become the sales rep that maybe I didn't want to, you know?
You haven't, Steve. I've seen New York.
We'll see.
How do you screen for people who would actually be good at working from home versus, I mean, now that we're in this world where everybody has to work from home, basically, in tech anyway.
I try and feel them out through experience for the most part. It is hard. Sometimes for product roles, I would ask maybe for some sort of take home assignment that gives me a level. I just need to understand how they write and how they communicate through their writings, because I think that plays a big role. But it really is a hit or miss. Like I've hired people that I thought would be good working remote, and from their experience, I thought would be good. And then it took more ramp up time than expected. I mean, you have to learn how to operate like on Slack, and I don't know if you aren't used to that level of communication and showing personality through that, it is difficult. It's a harder thing to get into.
Well, I think you also have to be really self-directed and like make sure you're not distracted. Like, you know, if you're sitting in an office, yes, it's easier, yeah, to be consumed, yeah, by the work, because you know, that's just what's going on. But
yeah,
you know, some people are better about, you know, not turning on the TV.
Time management,
all that stuff. Yeah.
Well, hey, you guys, I need to run, unfortunately, because I have a meeting. But Alex, thanks for joining the podcast.
I think we'll keep talking because I have a few more questions.
Chad, hit me.
Yeah. There's just a couple things left, I think, that I think would be interesting. So your career has obviously taken off, moving up through the ranks of product management. Do you think if we were in a pre-COVID, like most people working from an office environment, do you think your career would have taken off as much working in Massachusetts and kind of being constrained to like companies that were based there, which is what you were doing, I guess, before Elastic?
That's pretty interesting. I had never thought about this. I think I would definitely have a different perspective on how to work with people. I would have hoped for the same career trajectory. There's a lot of good product and tech companies in the Boston area.
It just feels like when you open yourself up to all the companies in the world, you know.
No, it's definitely a different mentality. And I will say that I probably wouldn't have grown as much as a communicator and a relationship builder than I have across different cultures. Like, I don't know, you just learn a lot about different people. You learn a lot about how folks in different countries operate, what's more important to them. And so it definitely sets you up for success to pivot into larger global companies. But a lot of in Massachusetts in particular, a lot of the companies here, I would say, are global and have this mentality. I would be hopeful that I wouldn't have changed my career trajectory, but maybe it sped things up working for a globally and remote company.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I think Elastic did really well was get everybody together on a regular basis in person. And how often do you think that should happen?
That's a great question. And I wish I actually thought about this when we were talking with Steve about kind of working remote, because outside of having it just generally be part of your culture from the get-go, I think the in-person meetup is probably the second most critical aspect of this. Remote working doesn't work unless you're seeing people every so often. At Elastic, they did every 6 months. At Zeta, we're doing every 6 months. And I think that is just enough time. The only other thing I'd sprinkle in is if you have enough people that are joining the company at the same time, then having something like an onboarding week at Elastic, they call it X School, that gives you some face time with people, whether they're on your team or not, allows you to kind of very early on in your time in the company, get to know folks in other teams and other parts of the org that maybe you wouldn't have been introduced otherwise.
Exactly. So, yeah. That sort of cross pollination.
Yeah, like I think that's big. I think every 6 months is probably enough, honestly, because then I don't know. Then you have that. It's like a long distance relationship. I don't know. I was in a long distance relationship with my wife for a while between New Jersey and Massachusetts, so maybe not that long, but long enough, right?
Long enough. Yeah.
Couple of weeks like go by, and I don't know. You really miss that person, and yeah. It definitely goes the same. I think for the teams that you work with and the people that you work with. Zoom is obviously not an intimate way to connect with people. So the first
it's
thing
very transactional. It's like, we're going to get on this call. We're going to solve this thing. We're going to talk about this, and then we're moving on to whatever's next.
Or we're going to get on this call. We're going to talk about things that aren't work. And then like it's very unnatural. Right. And so being able to come in and see people that you've been interacting with in that fashion for a while, the first thing I always did was go straight for the hug, which probably in a post-pandemic world, maybe not be the best thing, but like, I don't know, it definitely makes for much stronger working and personal relationships. And but 6 months to me is enough time, maybe a little less. I wouldn't go more than that because it just gives you an opportunity to really, really miss those folks. I don't know.
At Zeta, are you guys using ChatGPT to write code? Are you, for example, look, anytime somebody asks a question on our Slack channel, I'll ask them, did you ask ChatGPT first? Right? And I'll take their question and I'll post it into ChatGPT and I'll be like, look, this is the answer to your question. So I'm trying to get people to ask it before they ask anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely see some interesting use cases out of like knowledge base.
Well, not even that. I just mean in terms of like integrating it into the daily process for writing code. Like my contention is if you want to write code for something, you should ask ChatGPT to write it first because it might just... Yeah. Write an hour's worth of code in 5 seconds.
I wouldn't say that we've made that jump quite yet. We have toyed around with it, just like kind of like for, I don't know, internally, like what responses you get, sharing them kind of in a random channel. Just like there's some interesting responses. And then we've had thoughts around how we could actually leverage it in the products. And I wouldn't say that we're using it for code though. I don't know. That'd be an interesting exercise. At least I haven't seen engineers do that, but now I'm going to ask.
You should. Yeah, it's because literally every time I want to write something, I'm just like, I ask it to write it for me. And maybe it doesn't get it 100% right at the beginning, but it'll still save me an hour.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about disruptors, like assistive AI like this, I mean, this is certainly going to change. And I agree with what you and Steve were saying earlier about like the iPhone moment. This feels like one of them. I've seen companies leverage it for blog posts, for SEO purposes. Like it's definitely like, I think it's taking off, and it'll be interesting to see how this impacts the tech industry in particular and how people have to pivot kind of the roles and responsibilities that are used to do probably do more with a little less. I don't know. It's kind of exciting at the same time, but it's like, if you think about asking ChatGPT to write you an application and it's pretty good, it's good enough. Like that's an interesting thought. I don't know.
Is there something from your previous experiences at Elastic, let's say that you're consciously trying to do differently at Zeta now that you're head of product?
I would say the first thing that I tried to do was bring in metrics. That was something that I really missed. Not to say that Elastic doesn't operate kind of quantitatively at all, but there's a lot more that we probably could have done earlier on. And that was something that I wanted to do as soon as I joined Zeta.
You're talking about usage metrics, how people are using the product?
How people are using the product analytics generally, and being able to kind of make decisions based off of those. Elastic had a lot of data and they were doing like were really moving in the right direction, I think, and be able to leverage them. But that was something that I wanted to get kind of just implement as soon as possible. And I was fortunate enough that before I even joined, one of the engineers, Dan, pinged me and was like, hey, we're launching soon. What do you think about adding metrics to like as part of that launch? I'm like, yes, please do it now. I'll be starting in 2 weeks. Like, and so that was one thing.
Do they put the metrics into Zeta?
Not yet. We haven't brought them back in yet, but maybe at some point. The other thing, though, kind of related is experimentation. And this is something that I think you really only get with a SaaS product. And maybe it's an open source SaaS product, but being able to test things out and then kind of pivot if it doesn't work or lean in a bit more if it does is something that I really wanted to bring here. And we're starting to do some of that experimentation, and the results have been great so far. And so that is definitely one other thing.
What does that mean? Like presenting the feature differently to different people, or like running A/B tests on stuff? Like, what do you mean?
Yeah. A little bit of both. I mean, honestly, it's less A/B testing. It's more like we can try this out. Let's see how it goes. And if it doesn't, we can walk it back, or we can adjust things.
How do you walk back a feature that's been released?
Not walk back a feature. Maybe the things that we changed, I guess. We haven't had to walk anything back yet, but if there was something walk backable, it would probably be an A/B test. But yeah, as of right now, it's more of like, let's see how this works. And if it's successful, then we'll continue to kind of like go down this road. And I don't know, that was just something with at least the release cadence at Elastic. It was harder to do primarily because they came out every 6 to 8 weeks, and then it takes a while for people to upgrade.
Well, in terms of how you go to market, you guys are using a freemium model. So there's a free tier and then a paid tier. How do you think about drawing the lines between the free tier and the paid tier and deciding, you know, what goes in? And I remember at Elastic, there was always this talk about how do we take things from the paid tier and push them into the free tier? Like when do we say like, okay, we're just going to give that away for free now, even though we didn't before?
Yeah, that's interesting. That conversation at Elastic, I feel like, was more over time, bringing stuff into the free tier once we had enough differentiating values in the paid tiers. But at Zeta, I mean, we're very much focused right now on kind of a consumption-based model. And so driving that consumption in any way possible while they're at the free tier is certainly something that, from the product perspective, I'm thinking a lot about. I joined kind of before the pricing model was introduced. I think it is still early on. And so it's possible that could change in the future. I'm not really sure, but I do think that the consumption-based model works. We have a pretty generous free tier where you get all of the benefits of a high availability application.
Oh, it's not just dev features. Okay.
No, it's, you get 750,000 records, 15 gigs of storage. Like it's you can build something on it. And so making sure that you're successful even at that stage, we want people to find value in our product and then grow with them. And so if we have the right threshold or not, I'm not quite sure yet, but we're definitely thinking of ways to engage with our users more and make sure that they end up using Zeta more and more. And so that could be from within the product, and that could be things without it, like essentially more types of enablement, more ways to engage with the community to drive that consumption.
Is there some sort of target you guys are thinking about? Like, we want, you know, 90% of our people to be on the free tier, or, you know, something like that.
100% of people on the pay tier.
Like a sales guy. I like it, Alex. Yeah. I like it.
No.
Well, because I remember Shai used to talk about this. Like he would say, like, we only want like 5% of our open source users to end up paying for the product. Or, you know, that's kind of how he thought about it, because he wanted the biggest funnel possible. So he wanted tons of people using it for free, which is a little bit counterintuitive, but it totally works.
Yeah, it does work. And if you think of that with a freemium model, then you have people on your platform, and all the only difference between essentially them growing with you and not is their success. And so having a generous free tier is something that strategically we chose to do to have a large top of the funnel. And so I wouldn't say that we necessarily have a threshold of how many free tier people that we would like to see. We have the benefit right now that, not necessarily being an open source product, like we're not going to be competing with ourselves. So if people found us, if people liked us, they'll likely, hopefully, kind of spread that amongst their communities and introduce new folks to the top of the funnel.
All right. Well, you found your job by listening to this podcast. So I'm wondering if we could pay it forward. Are you guys hiring? What kinds of roles are you hiring for right now?
Oh, we are hiring. We're hiring for so many roles. Front end engineering. We're hiring for growth marketers, product marketers, really get the word out there and lead kind of a product led growth strategy. Those are definitely the top priorities at the moment.
Okay.
Kind of marketing roles and engineering roles. I think we have about 7 different recs.
All right. Well, I assume they're on the website, Xata.io, Xata.io. So if you're interested in that, go look at their website and hit Alex up on LinkedIn. I'm sure he's ready for a barrage of job applications.
Yep. Yeah. Yes. Please send them my way. Reach out to me directly, or we have them right on our site.
All right, Alex, thanks for joining. This episode's been great. It was our first episode with product management, and I thought it went very well.
Me too. I'm very curious to continue to poke at that idea of engineering incentives. Like that's, I don't know. I'm very intrigued to see what Steve's going to do at Empathetic.
Empathic.
Thanks for having me, Chad. I really appreciate it. And thanks, Steve, as well. This has been a blast. I really appreciate the time.
All right. For Steve Mazak, Alex Francoeur, I'm Chad Tindall. Thanks for listening to this episode, and we'll see you on the next one. Bye-bye.